I don't want to hear about how they killed people. I want to see them kill people. No, I'm not. I'm not big on violence.
Welcome to Keep It Fictional, a weekly podcast for book lovers by book lovers. Build your to-be-read list with Sadie, Liz, Virginia, Fiona, and Corrine from the Port Moody Public Library. Warning, this podcast contains strong opinions and may cause an increase in your library holds list.
Hello from the Port Moody Public Library. I am Virginia, here with my book friends, Mark, Fiona, Sadie, and Corrine. Now, listeners, your TBR, your to-be-read list is about to get longer. At least that's what we hope that we can do today. And for next week's episode, this is our quarterly report on books that are coming out in the next 4 months. So in this case, May, June, July, and August of 2023. Books that we are excited to read and can't wait to get our hands on. So each of us has chosen 5 books that have piqued our interest. So there are 25 books that we will tell you about for today and next week's episode. So since we have so many books, we should get started. We are going to go right into Mark. Mark, what is the book that you like to tell us about?
The first book that I'll be talking about is The Stronghold by Dino Buzzati. This story, which is originally from the early 1940s and has been translated to English once before many, many decades ago, but has long been unavailable. And now it's been re-released again for a second time in a new translation by the New York Review of Books Classics, which, as people know from these episodes before, I always mention at least one of their books, it seems like. So in this book, a newly commissioned officer named Giovanni Drago has received his first posting to the remote fortress Fortezza Bastiani. This fortress is located in basically like a barren wasteland of sorts. North is impassable mountains. To the south is a great desert. But he has been told somewhere out there is the enemy, whose attack he is told is imminently coming to this fortress from across the mountains and the wasteland that surrounds the fortress. And the novel follows Drago's lifelong wait for a great war that never comes, essentially, that he can prove his life's importance, that the fort is useful against some supposed nation of barbarians that will lay siege to it any day now. But as I sort of mentioned, that this day never comes, and decades pass, his lifetime passes, and he just basically passes away their life in this fortress waiting for something to happen without it actually happening. Just from like descriptions that I've heard of it, it almost sounds somewhat Kafka-esque in many ways, I find. Very similar to maybe like a short story, Before the Law, if anyone has ever heard of that one, in which a man from the country awaits outside the gates of the city for his chance to stand before the law and petition for entry into the city, but that day never comes until he basically gets old and dies. So that very much has that absurd, strange feeling that readers of Kafka and some of his short stories and novellas may recognize. I feel like that's definitely a lot of that going on in this book. Kind of has that kind of unseen and uneasy kind of feeling of expecting something without it ever arriving, desiring something without attaining it, of believing in something without seeing it, or accepting a mission without questioning or wavering from that kind of resolve. It's also sort of been posed in a way that like it almost anticipates the Cold War in many ways. Like I mentioned, it's from the 1940s, and then how the Cold War is basically like the anticipation of this great war that was going to occur that didn't exactly happen the way people anticipated it to happen. But I think given this kind of unease, I feel like it's going to be present. The novel definitely makes me interested in reading it. And as sort of, as I mentioned, like the NYRB Classics aspect of it, a lot of their translations also are very high quality. They commissioned this translation specifically for this release. So I have a feeling that the reading it and the actual feeling of the translation will be very well done as well. So that is The Stronghold by Dino Buzzati. So next, I think we will go to Sadie.
Thank you, Mark. All right. So my first book that I am looking forward to, it is going to be coming out May 11th. So I don't have too long to wait for this one. And this book, in typical Sadie style, combines magic, combines a strong female protagonist, kind of your typical Sadie things. And this book is called The Book That Wouldn't Burn by Mark Lawrence. So this book follows two different main protagonists, Levira, whose village was absolutely destroyed. She used to live in a tiny desert village and it was absolutely destroyed. And so she has come as a refugee to the big city of Craft City. And she doesn't know what she's going to do, but luck has found Levira, and she has been sent to train at a library. And she has been sent to train as a librarian. She starts picking up this knowledge quite quickly. While she is young and uneducated, that doesn't stop her from gaining literacy really, really fast. But she starts to figure out that she might not be exactly what the library is looking for in their training. So the other story follows a young boy, and the young boy is named Ivar. And many years ago, Ivar and four of his siblings were lost inside the library. There is a part of the library called the library's mechanism, and it's a well-guarded kind of mystery structure. And the power that the mechanism has is that it can bring any book to life. And many, many years ago, Ivar and his four siblings were lost within this structure. And then one day they reappeared. And the miraculous thing is that each of them reappeared with a particular new skill. And this skill is attached to the book that they were holding when they disappeared. Now, the only exception to this is Ivar. Ivar does not emerge with a skill. Ivar emerges with nothing. He emerges with this vague sense that something is missing from his memory. Something is missing from his life. And he's not quite sure what's going on. So now our book, I believe, shoots ahead 10 years, and now we see a full-grown Ivar, and he sets out to track down this mystery woman that he lost in the mechanism, who he's thinking has something to do with this gap in his memory. So as you can guess, he crosses paths with Levira, our trainee librarian, and the two of them follow this mission to try and help Ivar figure out what he's missing from his memory, from his life, and what exactly happened to him and the other four children, and what exactly is happening in Krath City. As I said, it sounds like a very Sadie book. I'm sure there will be adventure. I'm sure there will be, as I said, magic. There's a touch of romance, I imagine, between those two characters. And so I'm really, really excited about this one coming out. This is The Book That Wouldn't Burn by Mark Lawrence. All right, let's go to Virginia. What is your first pick?
That is a very Sadie book, but it's also Mark Lawrence, who writes a lot of grim, dark fantasy. So I'm very curious of what that is going to be like. Anyway, I also have a fantasy Sadie. And this, I feel like it's one of the more original fantasy I've read in a very long time. And it's unlike anything out there. It is a debut novel coming out in July by a Sri Lankan author. And it's called The Saints of Bright Doors by Vara Chandra Sakera. This book starts with this really wonderful first sentence. The moment Feather is born, Mother of Glory pins his shadow to the earth with a large brass nail and tears it from him. This is his first memory, the seed of many hours of therapy to come. I was hooked right away, and our story takes place in the city of Luriat, and Feather has moved there, started a new life, gotten away from his family. Things are going quite well. He has established himself in the city. He's become sort of the go-to guy whenever new people come to the city. They were like, oh, if you need help, go to see Feather. He also has a steady boyfriend, so relationship front going great also, and he has a good support system with a therapy group. Like Feather, everyone in that group is what they call themselves, the Unchosen. Told from a very young age, all of them were told that they would be destined to become the next leader of their church, of their religious group, of their cult. And they have trained them to do this. But yet something happened along the way and someone else ended up being the chosen one and not them. So now they're kind of stuck. Give all your life, that's all you have known, then it takes a bit of time to adjust. And thank goodness there's this support group there that help everybody out. There's also this really fascinating thing in the city that Feather is so obsessed with. It is the bright doors. And they are colorfully painted, hence the name. And any regular door could become a bright door. And nobody knows why and how. Every time when a door happens to become a bright door, you can't open it anymore. And so someone will paint it to make sure that people know what that is. And if you go on the other side, like if it's like a door in a house, you go into the house like from somewhere else, and then there's like, there's no door. Like, so on the other side. So, and nobody knows where this goes. And Feather is really, really curious about these doors because, unlike other people, the dwarves react to him in a little differently. And Feather already can see a lot of things in the city that nobody else seems to be able to see. So he's very, very interested in these dwarves. And so when an opportunity comes along where he can join a research team to study these dwarves, he jumps on the chance because he wants to know what it is about these dwarves and what is it trying to tell him. It was a great, great book. I feel like there's so many really, really cool concepts in this book. I have to say, I wish everything kind of come together a little bit better in the end, but I still feel like it's just so original that, you know, it is definitely a book that I want to recommend everybody to read. And I can't wait to see what the author does next. So this is coming out in July from my favorite Tor.com. It's The Saint of Bright Doors by Vara Chandrasekara. All right, I am going to send this over to Fiona.
All right, one of my all-time favorite authors is releasing a new book on June 6th. That is Lady Tan's Circle of Women by Lisa C. I've probably talked a lot of her books on this show before. And if you come to the desk and ask me for a historical fiction book, I will say, have you read Lisa C.? So she has a lot of kind of hallmark themes that she goes with. They're usually about women's history and about family, all of these things that I just like, they're just slam dunks for me. And I feel like she's had some books that are like a little less put together, like maybe a little less well edited than others. But even those ones, I just devour them. I'm like, I don't even care. These characters and these emotions that I know that I'm going to get from Lisa C., I'll just pick up anything she writes. This one, Lady Tan's Circle of Women, is about the 15th century China, and it follows a female physician. She is training her granddaughter in medicine. Along the way, her granddaughter meets and builds this friendship with a young midwife. She's kind of having a good life, and then she is put into an arranged marriage, and she has to give all of that up. She is no longer able to see this friend, and she is no longer able to do things that would be considered work because she's supposed to be the lady of the house. She's supposed to spend her days embroidering, and she can no longer study medicine. And that tends to kind of be the arc in the Lisa C. novel is like, you know, you have a good friendship and then something goes wrong and it's very fraught and very emotional. And I am just so excited to see a new protagonist from her and also to go a little further back in time to 15th century. And of course, it'll be a history of medicine, which is always very interesting. Super, super excited for this one. Okay, we are going to pass it on to Corinne.
All right. Much like some of our other readers, I'm back on my nonsense in that I am doing a crime book. Weirdly enough, I'm going to do a sequel. But unlike Sadie, who has deviant tendencies and buys the second book in the series, I'm not going to buy this because I haven't bought the first one, even though I really, really enjoyed it to the point where I'm reading the sequel. So if you have not heard of Colson Whitehead, he is a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner who kind of came out of left field last year. And he's, you know what? You know what the world needs right now? A cool, slick, 1960s rhyme comedy. And the entire literary world was like, oh, that's what you're doing now? And he said, yeah, because I'm Colson Whitehead. What are you going to do about it? And then he has again blessed us with a sequel to his very enjoyable title, Harlem Shuffle. And he is again following the crimes and misdemeanors of one Ray Carney, who really just wants to go straight. Like he really just wants to be a good furniture salesman. He just wants to pay his taxes and follow the letter of the law. But the world of crime just can't let him go. So whereas Harlem Shuffle was primarily set in the 1960s, the follow-up Crook Manifesto is taking place in the 70s. So it's a little darker, it's a little grittier because the 70s sucked. So it's a little bit rougher, but the stories look again to have that wonderful blend of social commentary and comedy and like very well put together Ocean's 11-y type crime where you get to the last page and you're like, oh, Ray, you did it again. So this again is going to have three separate stories, each kind of their own short story, complex plot that wraps up. The first one, which I'm very much looking forward to because I've been there, is Ray's teenage daughter really needs tickets to the Jackson 5 concert. And she is begging her dad to somehow find tickets to this sold out concert. And so Ray, again, he just wants to be a good dad and a guy on the straight and the narrow, but these tickets cannot be found for love nor money. And so he turns to the notorious crooked cop Fixer, who promises great upfront tickets to Jackson 5 in return for fencing some diamonds, as you do. The second one is set on a blaxploitation film where the lead actress suddenly goes missing and Ray has to track her down. And then the third one, as kind of paralleling the other book, is a little bit darker, is taking place during kind of the beginnings of that fiscal crisis in New York and is investigating a firebombing that happens. Again, I cannot wait for this book. It doesn't matter what kind of character he's depicting, whether it's like the crooked 1970s cop on the docks or like the slick politicians or like the crass show business people. Like, he always manages to evoke a time and a place to the point where as you're reading it, like, you can smell the thick miasma of hairspray in the air, and like, you can hear like the crack of the leather jackets as the characters walk into the room. He is just a wonderful writer, and I cannot wait for this follow-up. So yes, if you are looking for something light and delightful and then with some very sharp social commentary thrown in, I cannot recommend anything more than Harlem Shuffle, and I'm very much looking forward to the late August relief of Crook Manifesto. All right, and because we're playing Russian roulette of recommend me some books, I am going to turn this back over to Fiona.
Ooh, bold move. Very bold.
All right, well, I am going to bring you more of the same.
More of the same in that it is a author that I love and it is historical fiction. So I am going to Emma Donoghue's new release on August 24th. And if you're an avid listener, you may note that I had some interesting feelings about her last book. Definitely worth reading, but it was not what I expected. So looking forward to this. It seems to be a little bit more of a like a straightforward take. It is called Learn by Heart, and it is set in the 19th century and is going to be a boarding school novel. It is following the story of Anne Lister, aka Gentleman Jack, who has been branded as the first modern lesbian. So this story follows the relationship between Anne and Eliza. And I think that Anne Lister has definitely got the historical fiction treatment quite a bit and, you know, different takes. But what's interesting about this one is that it's going to follow her early life during those private school days and really focus on this relationship with Eliza Rain. Again, in my mind, Emma Donoghue is someone who can do no wrong, because she does the research. And I really love that kind of like grounded historical fiction that even if you're not crazy about the characters or you're not crazy about the plot or you don't agree with the take, you kind of like get a picture of what that period of time was like. And it's always interesting. So yeah, this one's going to be 19th century. So if that's your jam, if that's your historical period, you like the British boarding school thing, and if you want to learn some lesbian history, definitely check out Learn by Heart by Emma Donoghue. I actually had a really hard time choosing my five books this time because there is so much good stuff out there. So I'm going to swing it back now to Virginia.
All right. Well, my next book is another standalone fantasy novel, also a debut novel, but I really hope that there will be more adventures with these characters because they are just so great. This is from an award-winning Nigerian author. It's coming out in August, and this is called Shigiri and the Brass Head of Obalufon, and it is by Wole Talabi. And the author described this book as a fast-paced supernatural thriller with heart. And let me just say the word heist and heist a bunch of times. You know, nothing really can escape the clutches of capitalism, not even the gods. And so the book is set in a world where the gods and the deities all from around the world, including the Orisha, the gods of the Yoruba people in Nigeria, they have started to form companies. They call them spirit companies, and they have bosses and supervisors and employees, and everything, prayers, offerings, they're all now part of a business. And the most important thing that you have to look at is how this is going to affect the bottom line. And Shigiri is a minor god who works in this spirit company, and he's known as the nightmare god. So what happens is when people pray to him for the demise of their enemies, then he will pay those enemies a visit while they are sleeping. And then he will watch them as their mind unravel, processing the day, bringing up all the forgotten memories. Then he will tug on those threads that induce fear. Maybe like the person was like thinking about a time when it was like a scary episode in their life. And so he will tug on those threads, and then he'll make use of them, and he will turn their dreams into a nightmare, and then literally you'll be scared to death. And that is sort of what he does. You can tell, not a fun job at all for him, but you know, you got to do what you got to do. But one day on a job, he met Neoma. Neoma is a succubus who has lived in this world for a very, very long time. And Neoma recognized there's something in Shigiri, some ability of his that is very interesting and possibly useful to her. And also, they kind of have this understanding. They can see that they have some sort of shared experience. So she decided to offer him a chance to team up, to go freelance. And the carrot that she gives him is that I can make you desirable. Because as a nightmare god, everybody hates him. Everybody detests him. Everybody thinks he's disgusting. But Naomi said, I can offer you a chance to be wanted. And so Shigiri's like, sure, let's do this. And so they left the company. But of course, the company is going to be so happy just letting you leave like that. So they banished them from Nigeria. And now they are going all around the world to do their thing. But now they have a chance to get back. One of the gods have come to them for their service. One of them needed them to steal something back, which is, you know, in the title, the brass head of Obalufon. And this is currently in the British Museum display, stolen like many other things. And so they were told to do this to take it back. This god needs this head back somehow. And of course, like many other heists, there's always obstacles that people conveniently don't tell you about, you know, so that they can play down the difficulty of the task. And so there's going to be lots of not just your usual security that they have to go through, but because the spirit world kind of sits side by side with our world. So it's kind of like a heist across the two worlds. So it's super cool. And the book will take us from Lagos to Singapore to London to Ethiopia. And it also does the time hopping thing, which I love. So it goes back and forth in time to fill in those gaps so that you can learn more about the story of Shigiri and also Naoma. So, and how they end up teaming up. So for anybody who loves God Punk, this is a great, great, great book. And if you want to get a taste of Wale Talabi's writing before August rolls around, you can also check out his short story In Africa Risen, a new era of speculative fiction, which is an anthology recommended previously on this show by Gabriel. So check out Shigiri and the Brass Head of Obalufon by Wale Talabi. All right, I am going to swing it to Mark.
Okay, thank you, Virginia. So the second book I will be talking about is Goodbye, Airy by Tatsuki Fujimoto. Fujimoto, of course, is the author of the bizarre, off-kilter, and insane smash hit Chainsaw Man. This is one of several single-volume stories that Fujimoto wrote during the hiatus of Chainsaw Man, and it's actually very, very different from that particular work. So if anyone who's read that was turned off by it, this is very much a different kind of story altogether. It's also been available digitally since last year, but it's now getting a print release from Viz. It's coming out, I believe, in June. So this story centers on Yuta, a middle school student who is filming a documentary about his mother, a TV producer who is in the hospital with a serious illness. He ends up documenting her life as he hopes she will recover, but sadly she dies in his final year of middle school. And after she passes away, Yuta debuts his documentary about his mother at his school's cultural festival. While the film initially appears to be kind of like a straight documentary about his time with his mother and the familial bond, the film unexpectedly ends with Yuta unable to accept his mother's death and running away from the hospital as it suddenly explodes. The end. This bizarre twist ending is surprising and shocking to everyone watching. And the common belief is that Yuta's basically making light of his mother's death and disrespecting her memory, and that he has served very, very questionable motives and lacks basic decency, essentially. This kind of turns him into an outcast and the target of jokes at his school. He loses most of his friends and becomes isolated, compounding the loss of his mother. This is until he meets Airy, a girl from his school who actually loved his film and encourages him to continue making films. This leads to kind of a friendship centered on a love of watching and discussing film, the plot, the characters, and their own emotional connection to film. They don't develop a romantic kind of relationship, but they sort of form a partnership and plan to create new films together. And gradually they begin to reveal their own personal feelings and hidden secrets to each other while documenting much of it on film for one another to remember each other with. But as they reveal things to one another, we begin to learn that not everything is as it seems on the surface of each of their lives. And what they reveal and conceal in the front of the public and from the camera is part of a much larger set of complications in their lives. As what is shown or recorded is a choice on how someone is represented or remembered, whereas what is not shown is often obscured or removed in purpose in order to create a particular narrative or impression of themselves or someone else. And how we choose to create and shape a narrative about someone could be very much done through something like film. It sort of asks the question of how do we move on in a positive way after a potentially devastating loss, but doesn't do so in an obvious or sort of straightforward manner, leaving the reader wondering what was fact, what was fiction, as Yuta and Eri's real life is sort of blurred with the film that they are making. At times, you start wondering, like, are these real events? Are they staged scenes that are part of their film? Or are they selective memories that Yuta is recalling from the future? Because there's many scenes where they'll be filming a scene, but you don't actually know that they're filming a scene for their film until very suddenly it cuts. And then they're just talking like they normally are. And that reverts back to another aspect of like a filmic kind of fiction aspect. And very much the way that particular scenes are drawn or framed relates to those different kinds of scenes within the book. So it's kind of plays around with this fact and fiction, what is real and what is not real kind of aspect in an interesting way that I haven't really ever seen in very many written works, like be it a novel or manga. So I found that very interesting. As you sort of read through it, you kind of get to see like the deeper aspects and you sort of wonder like, how these characters feel deep down inside. You sort of learn more and more. And I found it to be rather unique in that way. And so even if you're sort of like, as I mentioned before, even if you're turned off by Chainsaw Man, I would say that you should still sort of give this one a chance if you find that kind of idea interesting. Because it's definitely not at all like Fujimoto's other works, except for perhaps Look Back, which is another single volume story that he wrote not too long ago that has much more in common with that than it does Chainsaw Man. So that was Goodbye, Eri by Tatsuki Fujimoto. And I guess we will go to Corinne then.
Okay. Yeah, it's time for romance. We've had too many serious books for too long, too many sad books for too long. We just need a little bit more romance in our lives. Hush it, Virginia. The spring blossoms are out. Like, we should be inspired by this. And in fact, my author was inspired by arguably, and I guess arguably by me, the greatest romance book of all time, which is Jane Austen's Persuasion. Fine. Pride and Prejudice is great. He's kind of a jerk at parties, but he's got a big house. Whatever. He's a romantic partner. I guess that's fine. But like Captain Wentworth and Anne and like the scene where she's like running past all the Georgian houses after she gets his letter where he confesses his love and like offers himself one more time. It's a perfect book. It's a perfect romance. And so, much to my total delight, I discovered that one of my favorite romance authors is redoing Persuasion, as are a lot of people, but in her own unimitatable style. I am, of course, talking about Uzma Jalaluddin, author of Hannah Khan Carries On and Aisha at Last. And now she is finally taking on top-tier romance of Persuasion in her newest book, Much Ado About Nada, which I am super excited about. If you are familiar with the story of Persuasion, then this is going to ring a lot of bells for you. If not, go and read Persuasion. Like, come on. It's so good. It's so good. Anyways, so this story is about Nada Ayed, who's almost 30, and she considers her life to be a bit of a bust. It hasn't really turned out the way that she and probably her parents had hoped it would. She's almost 30. She is still living at home with her parents in the Golden Crescent in Toronto, and she is very unmarried, much to her mother's total dismay. She is an engineer, so that's kind of nice. But the app called Ask Appa, which was supposed to be like her big launch into her bright, shiny new future, was kind of sabotaged by the betrayal of her business partner. And now she kind of finds herself at a crossroads, feeling kind of down about herself. And when you feel down, who is there to pick you up but your friends? Her friend Halima invites her to a Muslim conference downtown where she can network and meet new people and maybe get inspired to start her life all over again. And Halima will be there with her fiancé, Zane. And of course, Zane is going to bring his hot brother, Baz, who she may or may not, but definitely does have a past with, a secret past. A secret romancy past of which they never speak. And obviously something bad happened, but now they're back together. Anyways, so yes, they know each other, but they don't want to let anyone know. And so like sparks are going to fly, and are they going to say goodbye to each other again? Or will it be the beginning of something new and wonderful? Yeah, obviously, like it's a romance, but it's in the hands of like a subtle master of the craft. I love her other books so much. She is one of my favorite Canadian authors. Suck it, Margaret Atwood. So I am super, super excited for this release. I could read a million of her books every day. I don't know when it's coming out. I just know that I have it on pre-order through Chapters, so it'll be a beautiful surprise when it shows up. And that is Much Ado About Nada. All right, I have very much lost the plot of what number we on or where we're supposed to be, but I'm going to swing it over to my fellow romance tolerator, Sadie.
I do tolerate romance. I even enjoy it. I probably don't read quite as many just straight kind of traditional romance books as you do, but I do love a good romance. All right, speaking of favorite Canadian writers, if you have listened to this podcast, you know long, long ago that I would read absolutely anything that Kelly Armstrong released. Anything. No matter what. No matter what genre. I think that she was the one who, her and Corrine, I can credit both of you, who got me into mystery, because she wrote mystery and I had to read it. I had to. A couple years ago, she started writing historical fiction. It was not good. I hated it. I read the first one. I could not read the second one. So I pushed that aside as just being okay with not reading everything that she put out. Then she released a historical mystery that involves time travel. As Corrine has noticed, this is like the exact check marks that I would like for my books. And this series I quite enjoyed. The book that I'm looking forward to is the second book in this series, and it is called The Poisoner's Ring. I appreciate Kirkus Review has listed this as highly niche, but effective, which I think does a pretty good job of explaining these books. I was kind of laughing to myself, Fiona, as you were talking about the wonderful research that goes into the historical fiction with Emma Donoghue and how you just know that everything is so accurate. I feel like in this series, Kelly Armstrong has researched Victorian novels and has based her story around Victorian novels. And I'm sure she has done research on the Victorian era as well. But it just feels like she is feeding into fans of Victorian fiction, and that is who she is writing for. And I am there for it. I am 100% there for it the whole time. So our series follows Canadian police detective Mallory Mitchell. And I'll just explain a little bit about the first book. So Mallory is in Edinburgh. It takes place in Scotland as well, which is another big check for me. Yeah. Kelly Armstrong, she knows which boxes to check. So she is in Edinburgh, and unfortunately her grandmother is dying. And so she has been sitting at her grandmother's bedside, and she takes a break one day to go get some food, to go get a coffee. And she's standing in line, and she kind of has this interesting interaction with somebody in line. I believe she knocks into him, kind of in her head about her grandmother, not really thinking. She knocks into him. She spills coffee all over him. He kind of just brushes it off. He's not super upset. She feels really bad. He just kind of grumbles and walks away. So later that night, Mallory is out for a run, and she's running through Old Town in Edinburgh. And there has been a string of murders that have been taking place around Edinburgh. And she doesn't feel too worried. She's a homicide detective. She feels like she can pretty much take care of herself. But then all of a sudden she hears a woman screaming. Now, again, as a homicide detective, her first reaction is to respond to the screaming and to go help this woman. And so she follows the screaming to one of the little alleys. Oh my gosh, I'm not going to remember what they're called. They have a specific name in Edinburgh, and I don't remember what they are, but there's a whole bunch of little alleys. And so she follows it to one of those. But when she gets there, there's nobody there. Then she hears the screaming again. So she kind of goes into the alley a bit more. She doesn't have any weapon on her. She was out for a run. She didn't really have much, but she feels confident in her self-defense abilities. So she goes further into the alley, and there's still no one there. A close. They are close. So she goes into the close and there's still no one there, but she still hears the screaming. And then all of a sudden, someone attacks her from behind. They put something around her neck and they start to strangle her. Now, in this moment, Mallory is terrified. She is surprised, but she's also very mad at herself because she is doing and responding in the way that she has always told women and anyone who's getting attacked to never respond in this way if you're getting attacked. She doesn't do anything. She doesn't try to fight it off. She doesn't try to get the rope off of her neck. She just freezes. She blacks out. When she wakes up, she is no longer in present day Edinburgh. She is in, she is in Edinburgh 1869. And she is in the body of a young serving girl in a somewhat wealthy household who had also been strangled that night. Luckily, this woman, Katrina, she survived the attack, and Mallory is now in her body and living her life. So through this experience, she goes to work for Duncan Gray, who is a mortician, but also who helps the police solve crimes, because of course you do. Why would you not do that? And Mallory, being a homicide detective, decides that she's going to try and help him solve the crimes while not fully letting him know that she is not, in fact, Katrina, this serving maid who had no interest in solving crimes previously. So that's the premise of the first one. The second one, Mallory is still in 1869 Edinburgh. She is still working with Duncan Gray, and she is now having to solve a series of poisonings that all the evidence leads to the wives of these men who are being poisoned as the murderers. So she is now trying to use her present day detective skills in the past with the things that she has at her hands in that time, which is not everything that she's used to. So yeah, it's just a lot of fun. It's very fast paced. It's, like I said, not a ton of historically accurate everything, but if you are into historical mysteries, if you are into time travel, if you liked Outlander or anything like that, I think that this would definitely check those boxes. So this is The Poisoner's Ring by Kelly Armstrong, and I believe it comes out May 23rd.
Do they fall in love? Do they fall in love? Do they fall in love?
At the end of the first book, I don't think so. Not yet. I know. I'm trying to remember. I read it last year, and I was kind of in a sleep-deprived state when I read it, but I don't think that they do. But I think they're probably leading to that. That's my sense. Yeah. I feel like Kelly Armstrong is quite good about like the really slow burn. Like it takes, like in her series, it sometimes takes like 3 or 4 books before the couple that you know is going to get together actually gets together. So I think that that is probably where it's heading, unless she does some really weird 180. Who knows? All right. Fiona. What is your third book?
Well, first, I want to say thank you to both of you for picking up the Canada Torch, because I don't think I have any Canadian books on my five anticipated books. Yeah. So there we go. Thank you. So my third book is kind of a dark horse for me. It is a historical fiction, but it's not an author I'm familiar with, and it is a martial arts book. So this is The Water Outlaws by S.L. Huang. And I honestly, it's the cover. It is. Oh my gosh, it's the cover. I wish Liz was here to hear this, but look at that color palette. It's like, it's, if you're listening, it's like a beautiful black horse and then a warrior on top, but it's all like the colors are just beautiful. Like, oh, I'm salivating. So that is what really drew me to it. But then it turns out that it is also a queer retelling of a Chinese classic. So, you know, that definitely checks some boxes. So this is the story of Ling Chong, who is a arms instructor. Or at least she is, until she becomes a disgraced arms instructor. Yes. It sounds like a story of vengeance because her, you know, kind of good life, steady job is all goes up in the air when some dude screws it up for her. Her attitude has always been to keep her head down and just do the work, and then everything implodes. So she kind of gets outcast. And, you know, naturally, she joins a group of bandits, which sounds like pretty fun times. It sounds like it's, you know, like a very queer, female focused group of bandits, some rough and tumble, some more social justice focused. And it is kind of about, I think they're trying to tear down the social structure, the haves and the have-nots, and sort of upend that. And this one, I don't believe, involves math. But yes, S.L. Huang is known to write mathy books. And I wonder, I've not read anything else by them, but I wonder if any of the other panelists have. I know that they were nominated for, or no, I think they won a Hugo for short story. So definitely have some things under their belt, but not that I have read. I'm a little bit cautious about the martial arts aspect. Like, it's supposed to be pretty epic. Yeah, and very like cinematic. But I don't always find that that translates really well to books. Like, that's part of why I'm not a big like action person, because I don't want to hear about how they killed people. I want to see them kill people. No, I'm not. I'm not big on violence, even in cinema. So yeah, we'll see how that one goes. But, you know, at the very least, please drink in the cover. It is a beautiful cover. That's Water Outlaws by S.L. Huang. All right. If we're going to keep things going here, I'm going to pass it to Mark.
Okay, thank you, Fiona. So the next books I'll be talking about is called 24 Hours with Gaspar by Sabda Armandio. This book takes place decades into the future in Indonesia's crowded capital city of Jakarta, which is now underwater, presumably due to climate change or some other unknown disaster that's left the city completely flooded. A mysterious novelist searches what remains of the sunken city for the story of an old and infamous crime. He tries to comb the streets and go through the little alleyways and byways of the city as he can navigate them to try and find evidence of a mysterious person named Gaspar, a former private eye turned master criminal who plotted the robbery of a large store of jewels. So I've got another semi-heist aspect here, surprisingly. I'm not sure if we've ever had three heist-y kind of aspects of a book on any episode before, but it's kind of an interesting coincidence this time. However, in this heist, apparently Gaspar uncovered certain secrets and conflicts that may or may not be linked to what has happened to the city of Jakarta now in the future. It's somewhat unclear how they're going to fit the pieces together, but it does sound like that these different aspects are in fact interlinked together. And part of the story is going to be sort of uncovering that, how they're ultimately come together in the end. So it's kind of interesting, this kind of like detective noirish kind of aspect of like this future detective. There's the heist, but also kind of the futuristic science fiction aspect of the sunken city. So to see those kind of elements put together isn't something you see very often. I thought that was definitely a big appeal of this book, I think. The publisher even hints that there may be comedic and silly aspects of the story as well, which I thought was a little bit interesting. So we'll see if that pans out or not. But getting to see this kind of elements of Jakarta and Indonesian culture is also referenced throughout from what I've heard about the book. So it'd be interesting to get this kind of aspect of the story as well, because I don't personally haven't read very many books about Indonesia or from Indonesian authors. So to get that cultural aspect of the story as well, I think alongside those genre aspects will be interesting as well. And as far as I can tell, this is also the first book by Sabda Armandio to be published in English. So it'll be interesting to see more of this writer's work, hopefully in the future, if this one turns out as well. So the information about the book is kind of sparse, but based on those like kind of few elements that I've been able to find out, I think it's definitely going to be one that I want to read as soon as it comes out. So next, how about we go to Virginia?
All right. Well, I don't read romance, but I do have a book that has a subtitle that is called A Love Story. So there, Corinne. It's time for my annual book pick for the category. Ooh, this book has a weird, disturbing premise. I'm so going to read it. And oh no, it's going to rip my heart out kind of category. So this year's candidate for this is Emily Habeck's Shark Heart, A Love Story. This is another debut novel coming out in August. Now, this is a story about Lewis and Ren, and they are newlyweds. Lewis is a high school drama teacher. Ren works in finance. And then a few weeks after they got married, Lewis was not feeling good. So he went to the doctor and the doctor told him, you are in the early stages of a Carcharodon calcareus mutation. Lewis' physical body is turning into a great white shark. Now, give you a Virginia. That is all the information you need about this book. Sign me up now. Give you everybody else. Then you probably just like move on to the next thing. But it is one of those books that has this really ridiculous premise, but it turns out, like I said, to be gut-wrenching. This is the first part of the book deals with Lewis and Ren trying to cope with this diagnosis. Lewis, even though his body is changing, his mind stays human. So his body is not letting him do the things that he wants to do as a human being. And so it's really frustrating to him, especially because there's so many things that he still wants to do, especially when it comes to his art. And so he gets really angry. And of course, that changes his personality. That changes his relationship with Ren. And he knows that at some point when his body changed, he's going to have to be released to the ocean. Ren becomes this caregiver who's trying to salvage the time that they have left, you know, and dealing with the different difficulties now that Lewis is changing. And she starts to think at first, like kind of preparing for this kind of departure of and them separating. But at the same time, she's kind of thinking, well, maybe there's some way that they can stay together. Then the second part of the book, we go back to Ren's childhood and we meet Angela, Ren's mother, and we see the relationship with Ren and her mother. And it's a very difficult relationship. Angela's mother is just not the nicest. And there's also something that her mother is dealing with. And so Ren also became the caregiver, even though she is a child. And so all of Ren's experience is kind of summarized in one of the sentences in the book. It said that like Ren basically let others take up all the space they needed because she was always just doing fine. It's one of those books where, again, ridiculous premise. And if you are a magical realism readers, you know, this is not unusual because there's always like just this one thing that is a little bit different about from our world to their world. So in this case, is this people transforming into animal business? But it is very much a story about relationship, about changes, how to live a meaningful life. And it's done in like prose mostly, but there's also a bit of screenplay in there. And there's a little bit of poetry in the book. So it's just sort of a combination of different formats. And you all know I prefer sort of my existential crisis on a really weird kind of premise. So it's very much similar to Our Wives Under the Sea by Julia Armfield, which I love, love, love. So yeah, I think this is great. So if you can get past that shark business, I think this would be a really, really great read. And Fiona, I think this is a pretty good cover too. So this is Shark Heart by Emily Habak. All right, let's go to, who do we have? Let's go to Sadie.
All right. The next book I'm going to talk about, I believe that Liz talked about one of this author's books way, way back. This author likes to use Shakespeare as her inspiration. And so all of her books are based around and inspired by Shakespeare play. The first series, These Violet Delights, was around Romeo and Juliet. Then I think Lady Foul Fortune followed As You Like It story. And so this series, the first book is called Immortal Longings, follows Antony and Cleopatra. So this is Immortal Longings by Chloe Gong. And I read the first book of These Violent Delights and really liked it. I have yet to get to the next ones, not because I didn't enjoy it, but just because I haven't had a chance yet. And this book really sounds really, really interesting and really exciting. I'm going to preface this by saying I've read a lot of Shakespeare. I have. Probably more than the average person, just given my background. I've performed Shakespeare. I've read Shakespeare. It's been a part of my life for a very long time. I have not read Antony and Cleopatra, so I don't know a lot about this play or this source material. So when I read it, I will probably not read Antony and Cleopatra beforehand. So it will kind of be a bit of a fresh story for me. Now, one different thing about Immortal Longings, kind of different from Chloe Gong's other books, is she often sets her stories in Shanghai, and they're often historical fiction. So in the 20s or the 30s, this series is not set in the real world. So this series is set in a fantasy world. It takes place in the twin cities of San Air, and their capital cities of this country. Our first protagonist is Princess Calla Tuolemi. And Princess Calla Tuolemi has been in hiding ever since her parents were murdered 5 years earlier. Now, the reason that she has been in hiding is not because she's worried for her life. It's because she was the one who murdered her parents. And this is part of an elaborate plan that she has to take down the monarchy. Now, 5 years later, she has come back and she's wanting to finish the job by killing her uncle and taking over the monarchy herself. So she has come to the city of Tallinn. And in Tallinn, every year, they hold a sort of gladiator-style games. And these games are not just your average person-against-person fighting games. They use magic because the people of Tallinn have the ability to jump their consciousness in between different bodies. And so in this gladiator-style fight-to-the-death games, the people have to use that ability to win the games and to win the fortune. And Calla's hope is to win the kingdom from there. So she has enlisted the help during this process of her adopted cousin, Prince August Shinji. And he has decided that he's going to help her to kill his adopted parents and to help her take over the monarchy. And she also, along the way, meets Anton Makusa. Now, Anton is at the games fighting for his lover's life. And his lover has been in a coma for years, and he has been trying to save her, but he has basically lost all of his money doing so. And so his hope is that by winning the games, he is going to earn riches upon riches and be able to save her life. As you can imagine, Calla and Anton meet. Calla and Anton strike up an alliance, some might say, and possible love affair takes place, and Calla and Anton have to decide if they're going to choose each other or if they're going to choose the games, and because only one person can win, and so it can't be both of them. So this story, I'm sure, is going to have lots of intrigue, probably some betrayal, a little bit of romance, all set to the fun story of Antony and Cleopatra. I say shrugging because I don't actually know anything about it. So maybe. So if you're looking for something that is inspired by some classic literature, but with a new kind of fresh take on it, Chloe Gong is a wonderful author. So I would recommend Immortal Longings by Chloe Gong. And I believe that is going to be coming out in July. All right, we are going to go to Corinne.
Okay, would it be an episode of Keep It Fictional if I didn't mention BTS? No, it wouldn't. It would be something odd and different. So obviously, my next book is RM inspired. And this was very difficult because there's two books coming out, which he has graced with his presence. One of them being the new book by Hwang Seok-young, whom I love, 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 who did Familiar Things, Mater 210. But I think it's going to be a real bummer because it's about striking railway workers and like generational trauma of being working class. So I'm going to read it, but I might save that for a future episode. The one that I am going to choose to talk about was also read by RM, or at least on his bookshelf. And it actually has been nominated for the 2023 Booker Prize, which I'm very excited about. You are going to have to bear with me because every description of the plot that I've read feels like a fever dream. And I haven't been able to like get a real grasp on what this is about. Also, it's kind of cheating. The book technically comes out in North America on May 2nd, but due to the much lamented demise of Book Depository, I was able to get it earlier, and I'm going to read it this weekend, and maybe I'll report back about what the plot is. But here is my best shot from what I've been able to determine from reading like publishers' blurbs and Goodreads reviews of what happens. And so here's kind of what I've gleaned. A mother sells her daughter for 2 jars of honey. Okay. A roof comes down in the middle of a storm and reveals hidden treasure. Okay. An old woman seeks thrills after seeing a whale crest in the ocean. A mute daughter becomes a master brickmaker. And a one-eyed woman controls honeybees with a whistle. That's what I've got. Okay. So, as far as I can tell, a daughter is traded for some like really good honey. And then the person who adopts her transforms this daughter into like a really great brick maker who is called the Red Brick Queen, who eventually ends up in prison because she built a theater in the shape of a whale, but also might have lit it on fire and killed 800 people, but maybe not. And she gets out of prison and is sad, but it's also the rise of how to be a really good brickmaker. And then it's also a social commentary on post-war South Korea, as far as I can tell. So, obviously, this sounds like a great read. It is the debut novel from an author who is very well regarded. It is apparently a creed against the romanticization of the voiceless figures from history. I'm not doing a really good job with this, but to be fair, no one else is. But it was absolutely endorsed by Anton Hur, who is my favorite translator of all time. And it looks to be really good. Obviously, it's up for the Booker Prize. I think it's going to be kind of like magical realism, obviously. Oh, the daughter also communicates with elephants. But maybe confusing. And I feel like maybe at its core, this is a Mark book rather than a Kareen book. So, but I'm going to give it a try anyways, and it will probably be good. And hopefully Mark will read it and be able to tell me what it's actually about. So this is Whale. And I actually, because I bought it from Book Depository, which was out of the UK and had the much better Europa Editions covers. Like, this one's cute. It's got like a little whale theater, but I think this is a theater where 800 people die. So maybe not that cute. Oh, maybe the whale is about like trying to please her adopted mother. Oh, so like the, so she's punishing her mother by burning the theater because her mother likes the whales. See, I'm putting the pieces together. Anyways, this is The Whale by Chan Myung Kwon. Yeah, if you want to read it after my description of it, like, all the more power to you. All the more power to you.
I'm very curious to hear the report back on that one, Kareen.
I'll let you know on Monday what it's actually about. Again, I spent a not insignificant time trying to find out what this book was about. And that's literally all I got, is like a mood poem.
Now I can see again the power of BTS. This is so not a Korean book, but there we go. There we go. Well, anyway, thank you, book friends, for introducing us to all these wonderful upcoming releases. We have a few more to tell you, but you'll have to wait until next week's episode. So we'll keep you in suspense for now. Have a great week. Happy reading, and we'll see you all next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please tell a fellow book lover about it. You can find a list of all the books we discussed in our show notes. Join us next week for another fun book chat. Until then, keep it fictional.